Hello, everyone. I'm Major General, retired Clay Hutmacher, the President and CEO of the Special Operations Warrior Foundation. Welcome to a continuation of our series, Soft Spoken with Quiet Professionals. Today, we have Chief Warrant Officer 5, retired Dave Cooper, with us to recount some actions on a particularly harrowing mission on 27 November of 2006. Before I go into Dave's formal bio, I would like to point out, I've actually had the honor of serving with Dave for multiple years in the 160th Special Ops Aviation Regiment, and then later at the Army Special Ops Aviation Command. He's an exceptional officer and leader, and I'm a better man for having served with him. Dave, welcome. We're glad to have you. I want to take a moment just to go through your bio. And then I'm going to hand you the mic, and so you can walk us through the events of 27 November 2006, which I know very well, but I know the audience will be very appreciative and interested in hearing what happened that particular day. So Dave Cooper enlisted in the Army in 1985 and attended Army Warrant Officer flight training the following year. Initially, he was an AH-64 Apache pilot with the 6th Cav at Fort Hood, Texas. Dave flew several combat missions during Operation Desert Storm 4 years later. He saw the light and volunteered for the 160th Special Operations Aviation Regiment. After completing Green Platoon and transitioning to the AH-6 Light Attack Helicopter, Dave quickly progressed from fully mission qualified aviator, instructor pilot, operations officer to our highest qualification for an aircrew member, flight lead, and 1st Battalion 160th SOAR. He has deployed to Afghanistan and Iraq no less than 23 times in support of the global war on terror. He was awarded the Silver Star earlier in 2006 for a particularly dangerous mission, which claimed the lives of 2 of his teammates. Dave Cooper was the first Night Stalker in our history to receive the Distinguished Service Cross for extraordinary heroism as a flight lead during Operation Iraqi Freedom in 2007. He received the medal in 2007, he earned it in 2006. Dave Cooper was selected after that as the 160th Command Chief Warrant Officer. And following on, we served together again when he was the Command Chief Warrant Officer at the Army Special Ops Aviation Command from 2011 until he retired in 2012. Dave joins us from Clarksville, Tennessee, probably an almost stone's throwing distance back to our alma mater on Fort Campbell. Dave, thank you so much for being here with us and welcome to the podcast.
Sir, thanks for having me here. I first want to thank you and thank your organization for having me today. And I want to tell the audience that it's truly been my pleasure to serve with, for, and alongside Major General Clay Hutmacher. He's a outstanding combat leader and a great human being. He's well-loved back at the regiment, both him and his family well-loved. So thanks for having me today.
Well, thank you very much. And the check is forthcoming for that shout out to you. So thanks very much. So Dave, you know, I want to pass you the mic and talk to you or have you talk us through what happened on 20 November 2006. I was the battalion commander at the time, though I was not deployed forward with you. I was monitoring the battle very closely back at Fort Campbell. And I think the way you described it to Mary, your wife, afterwards was that was a particularly hard day at the office, the master of the understatement, to say the least, but because it was much more than that. And I'll also tell you that the highest, to the audience, the highest praise from us is when the ground forces we support acknowledge what we've done or give us a shout out. I spoke with the ground force commander that particular day many times following that mission, and his personal opinion he expressed to me every single time was that you should have received the Medal of Honor for your actions that day. And I happen to be of the same opinion. So Dave, with that, I'm gonna pass you the mic and please walk us through that tough day at the office.
Thank you, Clay. I want to start off by reminding everyone that Army and combat is a team event. And I was one person on the team. I happened to be there that day, and I promise you, anybody in the Army, certainly any one of the Night Stalkers, would have done the same things I did and that we're going to talk about today, but probably would have done it better. But as that being as it may, I do want to walk you through some of the events. First of all, it's hard to believe that it's been 14 years already. I don't know. It's just amazing. At any rate, I want to let you know that the AH-6 is that same helicopter that you used to see in the Magnum PI, right? That colored helicopter is very small. Two adult men can barely fit in the darn thing. And frankly, it only carries three things. It carries a crew, it carries fuel, and it carries guns. And it's called up by the ground force to support their movements, to support their activities on the ground. If they get in trouble, they might call the AH-6 to lay down some suppressing fire. If they see a target that they can't reach with their weapons, they'll call in the AH-6 to strike that target. So this particular day in November, actually it was a beautiful day. There wasn't a cloud in the sky, and we got a mission to go about 50 miles or so away to take care of a particular terrorist that we had been tracking. So that day, we had two Blackhawks filled with the assault force, right? The soldiers on the ground. We had two MH-6s. Now, these are the very small helicopters where soldiers ride on the outside of the helicopter, and that one lands directly on the target to insert the soldiers right to the target. And we had two AH-6s, the one I just described, and to provide fire support. So on that particular day, excuse me, I was the flight lead of that mission. So we're on the way to interdict the target, and lo and behold, I heard something on the radio that I had not heard before on the radio. Frankly, it's hard to get a Night Stalker to speak on the radio, number one. We never talk. But the microphone was keyed, and I heard someone say, "Mayday, mayday, mayday." And frankly, I'd never heard that. I'd seen a couple of B-17 movies in World War II. Where people had said mayday, but I had never heard it in person. I looked over and I had recognized my wingman's voice. I looked over and looked at his helicopter and realized immediately what he was talking about. His tail rotor was off his helicopter. For anyone that knows anything about helicopter aerodynamics, that tail rotor is fairly important. So without a tail rotor, there's not much control. So the wingman, being the outstanding Army aviator that he is, he still serves actually, he did a controlled crash landing onto the desert floor. Where we were in the desert, it was completely flat like a billiard table flat. And he was able to land the helicopter at about 80 miles an hour over the desert on skids. We don't have wheels on skids, and came to a controlled crash there. Well, the Blackhawks landed and disgorged the troops. They got out and formed a perimeter. And the MH-6s, they landed. Their troops hopped off their planks and joined the perimeter. And then I flew around a couple of times in a couple of circles, making sure that we were safe, and landed to make sure that crew got out. They were beat up, for sure. No broken bones, no internal injuries, thank God, but they looked as if they had just been in a catastrophic helicopter crash, frankly. We got them over to the Blackhawks, and they took off with my crew members there on the way to the hospital. It was about at this time when a ground force sergeant approached me and said, we're all very informal, said, "Hey, Dave, I wonder if you could crank your helicopter, get back up in the air, and look at these gun trucks that had just pulled up." And I looked over and I saw five trucks just pulling up, pickup trucks, small pickup trucks, if you will, with huge guns in the back. And at first, it was a time in the war we thought, well, it might be the Iraqi National Guard, or it might be the Iraqi police. We didn't know. And about the time I got to my helicopter, they started shooting at us. So it was fairly apparent that this wasn't any of the above, right? This was the Al-Qaeda had come to, they saw us land and come to the fight. So cranked the helicopter up and took off immediately. Now the crews that were in the MH-6s, They couldn't, there was so much fire, they couldn't get to their helicopters and take off. So they grabbed their long guns, their rifles, and joined the men on the perimeter and began firing back. So helicopter operations for the attack usually include at least two helicopters, where one helicopter is in the bump and shooting at the target and then breaks off. And then his wingmen then start shooting at the same targets, thus covering the flight leader's break, right? But we didn't have that. I only had myself. So got up and started, so the fight was on. I didn't want to get too far in front of friendly forces because I know these guys. We have been comrades for years and years, and if I had been shot down out there, there was no doubt in my mind they were going to come and get me, and that was not going to work. The other thing that dawned on me and the co-pilot immediately was that the gun trucks were shooting at us. They were not shooting at the ground force, which is exactly what you want to have happen. We're there to protect the ground force, and if they're shooting at us, well, that's fine. They're not shooting at the guys on the ground. And the next thing I want to say to make sure everyone on this broadcast knows that the bravest human is a co-pilot because their hands aren't on the controls. They're going where the pilot takes them. Their entire job is to go to arm and go back to safe on the weapon system and to point out targets. That's all they can do. So wherever I was flying, whatever I was doing, the co-pilot was frankly along for the ride. And he is, as I said, one of the most courageous people I know. So anyway, we got into the fight. The gun trucks are shooting at us. I'm shooting back. I do want to talk just a minute about the volume of fire that we were receiving. If anybody in the audience has ever been shot at, you would likely know that when the bullet goes past you, it makes a loud crack as it's passing the sound barrier, right? Well, in the helicopter, we have helmets on. We have all kinds of devices to keep the outside noise quiet so we can hear each other speaking. But when we keyed the microphone, it sounded like we were inside a bag of popcorn inside the microwave. It was so noisy from the amount of bullets going past us. It was just crazy. Well, we're shooting back, and it dawns on us fairly quickly that we are going to run out of ammunition. And there's just no way that we are going to leave the ground force naked without any air support. The ground force is shooting their weapons, all they're worth, but the targets are just at the edge of their weapons range. And so we could fly back to base, been a half hour back there, flying a half hour, land, rearm and refuel. That would have been 10 minutes and then fly the half hour back. So I would have been gone for an hour and 10 minutes. And there was just no way that my co-pilot and I were going to let that happen. And so what we did was land at the crashed helicopter. We landed there, put the engine to idle, let the blades continue to turn. We unbuckled our seatbelts, jumped out, and began taking ammunition out of the crashed helicopter and putting it into our helicopter. So for anybody that is reading their helicopter gunnery manual right now, I know that you know that it says you cannot use ammunition if it's been dropped more than 3 feet because it might not fire or it might fire inadvertently. But it doesn't say anything about being in a catastrophic helicopter crash. So my co-pilot and I jumped out and got that as much of that ammunition as we could off the crashed helicopter and put it into ours. And then we strapped back in and went back into the fight. We did that for a total of 4 separate times. On the third time we landed, we needed fuel. And we were very lucky that those pilots from the MH-6s were still there. They saw what we were doing, and they became our forward area refueling guys, right? So they were pulling ammo out of the crashed helicopter and setting it aside so that when I landed, they could just hop up and put that ammunition into my helicopter. Well, they also were able to use a Leatherman to open up a auxiliary fuel tank and get fuel out of that fuel tank and get that fuel into me. So now I had fuel and ammunition. So we were able to stay in the fight indefinitely now. About this time, we got the Air Force involved. And we had a combat controller on the ground as one of the assault force. and the combat controller was able to call in some F-16s and get him there, but he is having a hard time getting the F-16's eyes onto the target because it was so flat. We didn't have anything to tell him to, you know, from this intersection, go this many miles, look in this direction. We didn't have any of those things to point out to him. So finally, the F-16s saw the target that is interdicting, shooting at us, and we're shooting back. So the pilot of the F-16, of course, it's a single seat fighter. He saw the target and rolls in. He's got his guns on and he's shooting on his first pass and barely nicks one of the targets. He comes around again and we're cheering him on. You know, here he is, comes around again. And this time he's shooting at the target and begins to put rounds on the target. Unfortunately, he got what's called target fixation. And he kept his eyes on the target, forgetting about where his airplane was in relationship to the earth, and looked up at the last second and saw he was too close, and he pulled back on his jet, but he was too close to the earth and smacked the ground. He was killed instantly, unfortunately. This brave airman was Major Troy Lee Gilbert. And Troy left a family, right? So he left a wife and five children. But the crash really and getting rounds on the target is what drove the Al-Qaeda off that day. And what was left of their force packed up and left our force there. We were able to get, a little bit later, we were able to get the Blackhawks back in, pick up the ground force, and leave the area. I do want to say a couple things here. First, about the two pilots that were in the helicopter crash. They went back, right, and going to the hospital. The hospital was alerted. The helicopter that was taken back landed on the hospital pad. But instead of going into the hospital, the two crew members got out, walked past the gurneys, walked past the nurses, walked past the doctors, and trotted over the very first helicopter they could find that was loaded, got in it, cranked it up, and came back to the fight. That's the kind of men, that's the kind of soldiers, let me say it like that, that's the kind of soldiers that are in your special operations forces today and are in your Army and in all your armed forces today. That kind of determination and dedication to each other. The second thing I want to bring up is Troy Lee Gilbert. Like I said, Troy left a wife and family behind, five children. Special Ops Warrior Foundation is lucky enough to be able to support those children. And two of them right now are in college. One's at Clemson and the other's in medical school. So again, I just happened to be the guy there that day. But if this story moves you like it does me, the dedication of Troy Gilbert to get that F-16 there when his wingman wasn't there, to get rounds on the target to save his buddies that were in need. If that story moves you like it does me, I urge you to consider, strongly consider, supporting the Special Ops Warrior Foundation and all the things that they do. They're supporting the families back here at the house. I appreciate your time today. Thanks for having me, Clay.
No, a thanks, Dave, and very well said. And you're right. I mean, we were, when you say we're lucky to be able to support them, it is a privilege. And, you know, we support a lot of different families out there that a member of their family has made the ultimate sacrifice in the service of the nation. And it is truly a privilege to do that.
I'll tell you, Troy is, I didn't mention that Troy's buried at Arlington National Cemetery in Section 60, grave 8520. So if anybody's in the Arlington area and you want to visit the cemetery, stop by and say hello to Troy.
You know, interesting you brought that up, but you and I were both at his final interment. I know there were several, but when he was finally brought out, it, you know, to me, it was appropriate that Special Ops were the ones that went in and that recovered him ultimately and brought him out, and that it was a 160th helicopter that flew him back to the airfield where he was ultimately, you know, brought back to the United States and interned in Arlington, as you stated. A couple of questions for you as before we wrap up. So, you know, a key, and it, for all the aviators out there, especially the special ops folks, night versus day. You know, we call ourselves the Night Stalkers for a reason. We prefer to operate at night. Can you talk a little bit about the different dynamics on the target when we're operating during the day? I mean, obviously the advantage is with a little bird at night, you can't see them, but during the day, you can't help but see them, I guess. How did that, you know, how did that alter the equation for you?
At that time in the war, right, you're exactly right, but at that time in the war, we wanted to keep maximum pressure on the Al-Qaeda and the bad actors there in Iraq. And so we were operating 24/7 with the regular army and with special operations, trying to bring maximum pressure onto their formations. This happened to be a day event. Now, we did have other crews that were at night, but of course during this event they were fast asleep because they had flown the night prior. But yeah, at night you have all the advantages. It's hard for them to see us. We can see them perfectly. It's not nearly as exciting. During the day, it can make for a hard day at the office.
No, you're absolutely right. Exciting is a the master of the understatement there. Well, Dave, thanks very much for taking the time to spend with us and to join us on this series. You know, I'm honored and proud to have been able to serve with you and to call you a friend, and I'm a better man for having served with you. And I mean that from the bottom of my heart. And I think you personify, you know, our logo, our motto in the 160th is Night Stalkers Don't Quit. And you certainly didn't quit that day. And like I had said at the beginning of this, our session here, the ground force commander felt absolutely the same way. And he went out of his way to tell me and anyone else that was listening, that would listen to him, that you were the key. You were standing in the breach between them and a potentially very hazardous situation with the enemy. So thanks very much for joining
Again,
us.
Again, thank you, and thanks Special Operations Warrior Foundation for having me here today. I appreciate it, enjoyed it.
Well, thanks, Dave, and please pass my best to Mary and your ladies, your girls there back in Clarksville, Tennessee, and I hope we get
love your family
soon. All right, thank you, sir.
Night Stalkers Don't Quit.